Hello, welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. This afternoon, we welcome back the famous Bob Berman to the studio to field all of your astronomy-related questions. Bob is the astronomy editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac. He's written scads of books, the latest of which is Zoom, How Everything Moves, which is available in, several languages. It's all over the world in paperback. And Bob is always a great guest, always a popular guest, so I suggest that you get in early. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. If you have a question for Bob Berman, it's 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email us, voxpop@wamc.org. That works. Go to Facebook if you wish, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. You should see a Vox Pop post there, or tweet us at WAMC Vox Pop. But again, the number to call is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here, Ray.
Did you fly in today?
Nope. I didn't. Took the ground vehicle.
All right, fair enough. And this was from space.com. And I thought this was an interesting story for a couple of reasons. The title is NASA's Next Major Space Telescope Project Officially Starts in February. And I'll quote here from this space.com article. NASA's next flagship astronomy mission after the James Webb Space Telescope will become a formal project next month thanks to increased funding and direction from Congress, even as the agency looks to make cuts elsewhere in its program. The Wide Field Infrared Survey Telescope, WFIRST, I guess they call it, is in its formulation phase. Now, interesting, because NASA requested $14 million for this. Congress provided $90 million for WFIRST. And obviously, some politicians think it's very important. The Wide Field Infrared Survey Telescope is designed to perform wide-field imaging and surveys of the near-infrared sky. And I'm not exactly sure how it will do it, but it will help us find exoplanets and this mysterious dark energy. And first of all, remind us what dark energy is supposed to be.
It is the bulk of the universe ever since 1998. When we found that the universe is expanding faster and faster, or at least started doing that when it was half its current age, that makes no sense. It's as if every galaxy had rocket engines on it that all ignited at the same time about 8 billion years ago, and all of a sudden the universe's expansion, which was slowing down, started speeding up. So what could possibly cause that? And the only thing, nobody knows. So the idea is that empty space has this anti-gravity push to it.
Yeah.
And the emptier it gets, the more it pushes everything apart. So, of course, that needs to be investigated.
Okay. And then the exoplanets, I guess one of the key things, number one, this will be out in, as opposed to ground-based telescopes finding atmospheres of other planets. This will be out in space, and it will be able, it has
what a microlensing.
Right. And it has something that they call a coronagraph.
Right.
And what does that do?
Well, what we're looking for there, it's an infrared telescope, so it's really looking for the signature of heat, but just like any other form of electromagnetic radiation, as you line up objects, you get a halo around it. You can get all sorts of effects that show you that it's called microlensing because it actually bends space-time, the fabric of space-time, and it shows you the presence of exoplanets that might not be there. I love this whole idea of the WFIRST mission, but of the three principal investigations, I think exoplanets is the least important,
apparently,
frankly.
Congress doesn't agree, and that's why I wonder, because last year, they provided $90 million this year, and in fiscal 2015, last year, NASA requested 14 for this as well, but Congress appropriated $50 million. Why such
Three main things this telescope will do? One is investigating dark energy, which is super important because it's 75% of the universe.
It
pretty much has to exist because the universe is flying apart faster and faster, and what's causing it? Something is causing it. So whatever we call that, we call it dark energy, something is doing it. So
it's not a misunderstanding of gravity.
No. Dark matter might be a misunderstanding of gravity, but not dark energy. The second thing is to find out the distances to things more accurately, and that's another thing WFIRST will do by using type 1A supernovae, a standard candle candles, we could tell the distances of things more accurately. And that's the first step in really pinning down how the universe is expanding faster and faster. First, you have to know how far everything is, and then you look down the distance and you see how things are changing their size. The third mission of exoplanets, I mean, frankly, there are two bits of news, Ray, with that. One, the first one found 20 years ago, a 51 Pegasi, that showed us there are planets beyond our solar system. That was bombshell news, even though everybody expected that to be the case.
How long ago was that?
About 20 years ago in Pegasus, a fairly close star, about 54 light years, if I remember. And then the second thing is finding more and more of these, large ones, small ones. And now we know of thousands of exoplanets. So now we can be assured that most stars, that the Milky Way is filled with stars, and extrapolating, there's probably at least 1 million planets around stars that are the mass of Earth and have probably the same approximate temperatures of Earth. In other words, they're in the Goldilocks zone of their solar system where liquid water could exist. We know now that there's probably a million such worlds. So finding more of them and saying, okay, we know about that, and now we can identify this one and this one and this one and this one, I'm not really sure what that accomplishes.
Well, we know what that accomplishes. Ultimately, all of this is about finding another life.
But we never will unless we get either radio signals, intelligent life signals from a planet, detect oxygen in an atmosphere of an exoplanet, which we can't do currently. Well, except that free oxygen should only exist if there's plant life. Otherwise, oxygen has a habit of being soaked up by every element because it's so friendly to bond. It'll bond with iron, it'll bond with calcium, it'll bond with magnesium, with anything. So there's no free oxygen anywhere. Ray, anywhere. We don't see free oxygen, only on Earth. So why do we have 21% oxygen here? Because plants take in oxygen compounds like CO2, and they release the pure oxygen into the atmosphere. So we think anytime we're going to see free oxygen, that's the signal for plant life on that world. Barring that, it would take us centuries to actually go close enough to pin down that there's really life on any of these.
So this WFIRST will have a coronagraph. Now, you can also look at atmospheres via spectral analysis, right? This is different than that.
Well, the spectra...
Visually, in the visual realm, you can look at the spectrum of light through the atmosphere, right?
Well, through the atmosphere, yes, because... The reason it's tough is that planets, exoplanets, have almost no brightness at all. We've only recently been able to detect them at all, and they're too dim to show a spectrum. So the best you can do is a change in that star's spectrum that might indicate the atmosphere components. So far, that's yielded negligible results. We're hoping that someday, and maybe this will do it, be able to more pin down what the atmosphere contains.
All right, let's go to the phones. 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. Andrew in Beacon, you're first. Hi, Andrew.
Hi. I have a question, I would like Bob to say something briefly about Henrietta Leavitt. She studied the constellation Cepheus and the star called Delta Cepheae.
She's a hero. She's one of my real heroes in astronomy.
Yeah. Pulsating variable, something about luminosity is the intrinsic thing about a star.
She was the real hero behind Hubble.
Edwin Hubble.
Yep.
She had to have laid the groundwork for Edwin Hubble.
That's right. And then, unfortunately, women were so... second rate and so unacknowledged.
Marginalized.
And it even continued right till 1968 when you got Jocelyn Bell who discovered the existence of pulsars, and she got exactly no credit. She did not win the Nobel Prize. Her mentor did. So that kept up right till the 60s, and it was really horrible, disgusting that Leavitt, who, you're right, essentially pinned down what Cepheid variables are, and it was Hubble who used that to be able to say that, yes, Andromeda is a...
So he's got his name on a telescope, but she doesn't.
Yes, that's right, and it's wrong.
Yeah, well, okay, if you have any further comments, please. Okay, thank you.
Hey,
okay,
Andrew, sure thanks thing. A lot for the call. Well, before we take a break, let's take another call at 800-348-2551. Mariana, on the road, I hope your hand's free, you okay?
I am hands-free. I'm on the wheel.
All right, good. Well, you are on the air with Bob Berman.
So I have a really kind of ridiculous question, I think.
We like that.
But I just, I had this burning question for several times and missed your show. Anyway, my smartphone, when there are meteor showers in the air, when you predicted them, Bob Berman, shows up on my iPhone. Is that really crazy?
Now, what do you mean shows up on your iPhone? How does it show up?
Well, all right, so it's nighttime, and I turn my phone on, and I check my weather app on my phone, and I see shooting stars.
So it's a weather app.
And it's my weather app on my iPhone.
Well, I mean, they're predictable. The big ones are predictable,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, they are. Now, I'm still not understanding. Do you mean that you're seeing a flash of light on the cell phone screen or hearing like a whiz on the screen? What do you mean it shows up? Or do you just mean that some app tells you, yes, there's a meteor shower tonight?
No, I'm seeing stars in the sky. You know, the app, you know, like it says Shelburne Falls, 18 degrees out, has a night sky with stars in it. And I will see shooting stars.
Oh, you know what that is? Stars. You know what that is? There are some apps that when they're depicting the sky, show meteors. They're not really depicting meteors as they occur. That would be the greatest thing in the world
sure
if there was, because they can be detectable. Sure, they can be detectable by the electromagnetic signature thing, by the ionization of air. They can be detectable by radar. And someday it would be great if someone then, after detecting it, showed it on everyone's iPad or iPhone and showed the actual meteor in real time as it was happening. No, that's not available. What you're just seeing is that some apps display an occasional artificial meteor across the sky.
So the Leonids are happening tonight, so there'll be a meteor.
Yeah, and
the
then they show something that looks like a meteor just to make the sky look more realistic.
Bob Berman is our guest. Thanks for the call, Mariana. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. We'll be back.
Support for WAMC comes from NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses. NBTBank.com. Agricultural Stewardship Association, helping people conserve farmland in the Upper Hudson Valley. We conserve good farmland for good forever. AGStewardship.org. And John Lee Auctions, offering estate liquidations, appraisals, and auction services for over 40 years, purchasing jewelry, coins, silver, gold, art, and antiques throughout the Northeast. JonLeeAuctions.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Bob Berman is the guest. Ray Graff here. You there? 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. And let's go to Felix in Milan, New York. Felix. No, let's hit the button, Ray, you dope. Here, try this. Felix, are you there?
Yes, yes, yes. I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. You're on.
Well, thank you very much, Ray, and thank you very much for this opportunity. Now, my Uncle Ben used to drive a Dugan's bread wagon, but wait now. There's something about this show that piqued my imagination. He left me a whole pile of Astro Boy comic books. So I wonder if your guest could tell me where I could to sell my comic books, Astro Boy.
Okay.
And by the way,
yes,
on the Dugan's bread truck, there was the most popular bread was a white bread in Brooklyn at the time on Livonia Avenue.
All right. Hey,
so I will take your answer off the air. Thank you very much, and good luck to all of you.
Felix, have a happy new year. Well, Astro Boy comic books.
Well, thank you. Of course, I have no idea how to sell Astro Boy comic books.
Felix
no
is
idea?
Just having fun. He
yeah,
may
I
not even
so.
Be
okay.
named Felix. Let's go to Gil. If that, in fact, is your name. Gil, you're in Yeagerville. You're on.
Yeah. The big smattery explosion, the Big Bang, what speed? It was going faster than the speed of light because we don't, and not normal physics we have now. So what speed was it then? Was it faster than the speed of light? And did it to basically stay that way? What speed is the expansion happening now? Or is the speed of light going to be the ultimate limit of the speed of the expansion? That's it.
Good question. Well, when the Big Bang first happened, everything did expand faster than the speed of light, but only for a fraction of a second. So you could picture it doubling in size from an infinitesimal step to a doubling, to a doubling, to a doubling, to a doubling, all faster than light. But then that process stopped and everything was free to coast. And from that point on, the expansion continued just from, I guess you'd say, inertia, but slowing down because everything's pulling on everything else gravitationally, like a giant spring. So currently, and then, of course, there's the extra wrinkle that when the universe was about half its present age, things started speeding up again. Bottom line to all this is when we look out in all directions, for every million light years further away that we see, objects are moving away from us 14 miles per second faster. 14 miles per second per million light years distance. Now, this is usually expressed in kilometers per second per megaparsec, and then you get a figure closer to 70-something. But most people can't relate to megaparsecs. We all, you know, appreciate what a light year is, the distance light can travel in a year. So figure 14 miles per second per million light years distance. So when we look at something that's, let's say, 2 million light years away, then it would be 2 times 14, 28 miles per second rushing away from us. Bottom line is the farther we look, the faster things are rushing away from us. And this just shows that if you could extrapolate in reverse and trace back the path of everything, we get to one spot at a certain time in the distance. That time was about 14 billion years ago, and that one spot was right in Saugerties, New York.
So have we reached basically gone beyond the midpoint of the universe or the cosmos, and now it's speeding up? Are we going to approach the speed of light or pass it? You know, it's going to be a billion years in the future.
Well, yes, it already is passing the speed of light, because that 14 miles per second per million light years means as you look farther and farther away, there's a distance at which things are expanding at the speed of light. And that's about 13.8 billion light years away. And at that distance from us, we see galaxies racing away at the speed of light. We can't quite see those because the light would never reach us from those. But
so
we see galaxies just ahead of there. But at that point, things are going away faster than the speed of light. And beyond that, they're going away faster than the speed of light. So when people say, hey, wait a minute, nothing can go
fast speed of light. Right?
No, but these are.
Oh,
In fact, most of the universe, no doubt, is racing away from us faster than the speed of light, starting at that boundary distance.
All right. Well, Gil, great question.
Is it going to be the big rip?
The big rip?
The big tear?
Well, that's one idea.
What do you mean the big rip?
Well, one of the many ideas, and I'm not fond of speculation because we have so little data about what's going. We're still gathering data desperately. So when we come to ideas, well, could it be brains, cosmic membranes? Could it be a tear in the fabric? Could it be a quantum mechanical fluctuation that caused the Big Bang? There's all sorts of ideas and no hard data supporting them. So I'm less fond of speculation because you can say anything, and more hoping that as we get older and older, we'll find things that are actually falsifiable. In other words, we can get hard observational experimental data that gives us more information about that. Right now, we're in our infancy understanding what's going on with this. It's interesting that when we look at the moon or Mars, we can really pin down things. We know the size and the composition. We know that Copernicus crater has mountains 12,000 feet high around, and the crater itself is 54 miles in diameter. We know things.
Yeah.
But when it comes to the basic questions about reality, existence, about the universe itself, we're still learning what it's made of, whether it's infinite or non-infinite, finite, what the future is, and really what's going on, and whether the Big Bang was really a beginning. Obviously, you can't get things out of true nothingness. So what preceded the Big Bang? What caused it? These are fundamental questions, and let's try to tackle these first before we come up with ideas about putting meaning on it.
We don't even know if we have the questions right.
That's right. Quite right.
All right,
well said.
Let's go to Ray in Gloversville. Ray, you're on.
Yes, I've got a question on finding True North at local noon.
Okay, this is great.
So my question is related to the analemma. So there's an application on the Weather Channel locally that shows that my local noon is about 11:45 a.m. in November, and it's now about 12:04. So my question is the sun in the exact same spot? So I'm actually getting true north every time I observe it, or is it a series of parallel lines? I'm a little confused because if you see the analemma, it's that nice figure eight.
Yes, and since you mentioned the analemma, so that people listening in going, what is he talking about? The analemma is a way of comparing the sun's position in the sky with what our clocks are saying. Now, I know you know the answer, the caller, to this, but let me just take a few seconds more so everyone understands what we're talking about. If you would look at the sun every day at the same time, let's say noon, and either take a photograph of it day after day after day, or make a drawing of it, you'll get a huge figure eight in the sky with a north-south orientation. The northmost point of the sun is the summer solstice on June 21st. Southernmost point, of course, is going to be the winter solstice on December 21st. The left and right is more puzzling to most people. Why should the sun arrive at due south at a different time every day? And that's because couple of reasons, one of them being that Earth travels in an ellipse, not a circle around the sun, and so we speed up and slow down, and therefore, but our rotation stays the same. So if you're looking toward the sun at exactly noon one day, well, at this time of year, we just passed, just 2 days ago, we passed our closest point to the sun, and as Kepler's second law tells us, it means we're traveling through space at our fastest speed right now, Earth is. We're closer to 67,000 miles an hour instead of our true average of 66,000. That means that we're moving so fast around the sun at this moment that as we rotate, and our rotation stays the same, make a rotation of 23 hours, 56 minutes and 4.1 seconds. As we do that, the sun is not in sync. We make one rotation, and where we'd expect to see the sun overhead, or at least due south, the next day, we've moved so far that to get the sun at the same angle from Earth in space, we have to let a little Earth rotation more take place. And therefore, the sun takes more than one day to appear in the same spot in the sky. And because of that, that's why you have found that the sun does not appear in the south at noon, but at 4 minutes after noon. It can be as much as 16 minutes off noon or before noon as the year goes on. And that produces that right and left component, that east-west component of the analemma. The analemma shows us how the sun differs at noon from being exactly in the same spot in the sky. So you're quite right. You need to use the analemma or correction or data, a table correction of when the sun is exactly due south. And that's when a vertical stick will cast a shadow due north and show you true north. Was this helpful?
I think I'm getting it. I mean, the question about the equal area law and going faster now and then slightly slowing down. I mean, I do notice the afternoon is much longer and sunrise has not yet moved until about next week. So.
Well, that's a consequence of it. And if you let the analemma travel, you know, it's an imaginary thing in the sky, of course, but if you let it travel where it's going to touch the southwestern horizon, the sun on that date will show us the earliest sunset, which turns out to be December 7th every year. And so the earliest sunset is not at the solstice on December 21st, but where the analemma, where the sun's position on the analemma, touches that horizon. And so if you just watch the analemma as it rises, as it reaches the noontime spot, that figure eight, and as it becomes tangent to the southwestern horizon, that will show you the dates of the latest sun rise, which we're getting this week, by the way. The darkest mornings are this week, mm-hmm. and the darkest afternoons, which were a whole month ago.
Let's go over to John in Canaan. John, you're on. Oh, God, what's up with this? Hello, let's try another button here. I think I just hung up on John. Let's try Michael in Middletown. Sorry, John. Michael, you're on.
Yeah, hey, just a quick philosophical question. You touched on it earlier. I was wondering if there's any similarity in the quantum physics field to how the planets and these solar systems and galaxies, how everything forms on that big a scale. If there is now, or I guess if you predict there ever will be, a connection in those two fields.
Well, there's two ways to answer that. One is to see if the analogies work, and they really don't. The early on, it was tempting to say that planets going around the sun is analogous to electrons going around an atomic nucleus. But in fact, it's a poor analogy because atoms are 10,000 times emptier than solar systems relative to their components. Atoms are 10,000 times emptier. And the other way it doesn't work is that there are things that go on in the quantum world that just don't happen in the classical world. For example, in the real world here, a pumpkin is either on this part of your kitchen counter or on this part. The moon is either here or it's there. But in the world of the tiny, things can occupy two places at once. They can do things that are impossible logically. For example, we can do an experiment showing that an electron has neither taken path A nor path B, nor both paths, nor neither path. And those are the only possibilities we can entertain in this experiment. So it does something outside of logic. And we have a word for it. We say the electron is in a state of superposition, but naming it doesn't mean you really understand it. It's non-logical the way it behaves, whereas the classical world is very logical. You could have two baseballs. When they hit each other, you would never expect both to disappear. Whereas with waves, you can have two objects that are essentially made of waves, two electrons, and they can cancel each other out. So you can be left with essentially nothing, or see in the double slit experiment places where there's blankness behind a screen that you're shooting electrons through. So no, they're two different worlds. And of course, there's an ongoing search to see at what level or what size we switch from the classical transition, and why and what causes it. We still don't know. Is it gravity? Is it contamination? Is it that with larger objects you have too many waves involved so that there's interferences? There's studies furiously underway to see at what size and why and where you might get quantum effects extending into our macroscopic world.
Michael, thank you so much for the call. Let's try now John and Kanan. John, are you there?
I am.
Okay, you're on.
Thanks very much. Bob, I hope you can clear up a confusion I've been having about the nature of gravity.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, this should be something very simple for a guy who is so good at explaining things as you. I mean, on one hand, didn't we learn from Newton that, and don't we all think of gravity as an attractive force between large bodies? But on the other hand, aren't we told that space is bent by gravity?
Yes, and both
so,
of these.
Is gravity two different forces, or are both those phenomena happening in what I would think of as the same direction?
Both of those are just ways of conceiving of it. And gravity, of the four fundamental forces, gravity remains the most mysterious. Now, it's true that Newton would have conceived of it as any object with mass. Proportionate to its mass, it exerts a pull.
Mm-hmm.
Einstein didn't like this idea of a mysterious pull on an object on another, and most people think of it today as the warpage of space-time, and things just travel through the laziest, easiest path through the curved space produced by any object of mass. And by this reasoning, when you drop your keys, the keys aren't really being pulled by Earth's gravity. They're just simply falling along the shortest, easiest path called a geodesic, along the curved space-time in the vicinity of, in our vicinity, caused by Earth's mass.
But in that explanation, is gravity a force?
In that explanation, gravity is a thing that has changed the configuration of the local space-time.
So it's a rut in the space-time?
What you do is you stop thinking of space and time as separate items, and you think of them as a single entity. For example, let's say you get a batter hitting a pop-up, and it goes from the bat to the second baseman who catches it. Now, it takes a long time because the ball is popped high in the air and then comes down the second baseman's glove. Next batter up hits a line drive, also caught by the second baseman. It takes less time to get to him because it didn't go high in the air. But as long as it went from the same spot, the batter, to the same location of where the second baseman was, as long as it traversed that and it had no rocket engines on it, so it's flying freely, both of those tracks are identical in space-time. Instead of seeing space and time being separate, one occupied more time but traveled a different, a longer path through space, and the other had a different through those. Now, if you did the field equation, you'd see that those are identical paths through space-time. So that's what Einstein did for us. He let us see how things must move, how Earth traveling around the sun is just falling in the laziest, easiest, shortest path through the warped space-time produced by the massive sun. The sun is, has a lot of bulk to it. It weighs the same as 333,000 Earths. So Earth is just falling through the space-time. But here's the point for this caller, is that either way is just an explanation of what it's doing. Einstein really didn't believe there was such an actual item of space-time as if there were three-dimensional graph paper. It's not something like a cucumber that you can take and analyze in a laboratory. It's still only a way of describing what we see. What it actually is still mysterious, gravity, okay, regardless of how you picture it.
Okay, but now I know why the Mets have had so much problems at second base, because their second baseman couldn't figure out space-time. Now I understand. Let's take a break. 1-800-348-2551. And Bob Berman's here. We'll talk sports. We'll talk some astronomy. Eh, whatever. It will be good. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from Amherst Copy and Design Works, offering printing and copying, sign making and design services, from booklets to stationery and labels to lawn signs in downtown Amherst, Massachusetts. AmherstCopy.com. Lori Stillwell, CPA PC, providing tax and accounting services for businesses and their owners in Saratoga Springs and beyond. StillwellCPA.com. Unusual Wedding Rings and More in Crawford Square, North Street, downtown Pittsfield. A jewelry emporium providing traditional and non-traditional engagement, wedding, and anniversary rings for conventional and same-sex couples. UnusualWeddingRings.com. And the Arthur Zantkel Music Center at Skidmore College, a cultural resource for the upstate region, providing a teaching, recording, and performance venue with rental options available. Skidmore.edu/ZANKEL.
You see, the Mets had a lot of errors at second base. Daniel Murphy, good hitter, but he couldn't field that well. And now I realize he didn't brush up on his Einstein. So there you go. Bob Berman is our guest. The number to call is 800-348-2551. Let's go to Daniel in Great Barrington. Daniel, you're on. Jeez, what's up?
Yeah.
There you are. Hello.
I'm coming.
Okay, well, you're here.
I'm going to turn off the speaker phone.
That's a great idea.
Yeah. So I thought.
Okay.
All right, I'm going to ask you a dumb question. Do you think that God has anything to do with this?
I love it. He won't answer it, but I love it.
Yeah, and the reason I won't answer
it. I thought it was a dumb question.
No, it's a good question.
No, of course it's a good question. These days, astronomers and cosmologists, these are essentially the priests of today. These are the people that are asked about questions like this. And the only reason I won't answer it, of course I have personal beliefs in all this, is randomness. Is a dumb universe real? Is there intelligence behind nature? Can you prove it? Sure, I'd love to talk about this. But, you know, I always believe that this microphone in front of me hasn't been given here just for me to spout my personal wisdom, even though I'm so tempted to do it all the time. So
why don't you just
spill your guts?
If you were here personally, if the show were over and you were asking me personally,
tell me
personal,
how you really feel,
Daniel. Let's turn it quickly upon you. What do you think?
I think we're under his control. To be honest with you.
I think that's as good a theory as any. Daniel, thanks a lot. This one comes in via email from Paul. It says, I can't call because I'm at work, and this isn't strictly an astronomy question. Well, what the heck, Paul? All right, well, let's see what you got here. I wonder if Bob would comment on the successful landing of the SpaceX Falcon 9 recently. Is it as significant as it seems to me? Such commercial
flight.
I think
it is.
You know, it
I watched the whole mission, they tried a few times on ocean floating platforms in the ocean. The last time I actually managed to land it on that floating barge, but it was because of the sea, it's tipping back and forth, so the thing just tipped over.
Yeah.
But, you know, actually being able to do it for the first time, launch satellites and then have that first stage come back, essentially just a few miles from where it started, and land and be reusable. Darn right, that's a breakthrough.
Haven't the Russians been landing things that way for years?
Have they? I don't know.
I thought they were.
First stages reusable?
Well, I don't know about first stages, but I thought they used to land, come back down, the rockets would come back down to Earth.
You know, you may know something I don't about that, but this is certainly a breakthrough, and it's certainly going to change the economics of launching, and hats off to them, to SpaceX and Elon Musk for pulling this one off.
All right, let's go to Jim in Albany. Jim, you're on with Bob Berman.
Yes, thank you for taking my call, Ray. I've never heard an adequate explanation of why the objects in the sky, sun, moon, and even the constellations, look much, much larger near the horizon than they do when they're overhead.
Okay. That's called the moon illusion because it was originally applied to the moon. Everybody notices that when the moon is rising or setting, it looks huge. And when it's high in the sky, it looks normal or it looks much smaller. And some have falsely thought that it has to do with the air magnifying it or distorting it or all sorts of things. And the answer is just simply that it's a very strong optical illusion caused by the fact that throughout our lives, we always know and learn, and experiences have taught us that things on the horizon are far away. If you're driving on the road and coming over a hill and there's a distant town, everything in that town, and that's very near the horizon, if it's far away, even the church steeples, everything have a certain size. And in our minds, we know it's far and we compensate. So now here's the moon, only half a degree wide. That's only 1/360th the size of the sky from horizon to horizon. It's tiny, the half degree size of the moon. And when it's against the horizon, we see it juxtaposed near distant church steeples and houses and the rest, and that gives it size. Whereas when it's high in the sky, that half degree is dwarfed by the hemisphere, the empty hemisphere of the sky. The interesting thing, and you can make that illusion go away by using a paper towel or toilet paper tube. If you look at the moon through that, both when it's high and when it's low, it'll look the same size.
Huh.
It removes the illusion entirely. You got to see the horizon near the moon to have that illusion. But here's an extra wrinkle that I've never seen in print anywhere, and that is if you actually measure the size of the moon, and this applies to, as you said, constellations or anything in the sky for the same reason, but if you actually measure the size of the moon when it's low, it's a little smaller, like an instrument like a filar micrometer that can show the angular size of the moon. The moon actually gets bigger and bigger higher and higher. Several percent. Why? Because when you think about it, you're on the turning Earth, and where are you when the moon is on the horizon? You were one Earth radius further from the moon.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Whereas when the moon is high in the sky, you're on the bulge of the Earth closest to the moon.
So it's 7,000 miles closer.
Yes, or at least Earth's radius, 4,000 miles out of the 238,000 miles.
Okay.
That's a few percent.
Yeah, all right.
Now, a few percent isn't really noticeable, but it's measurable.
Very interesting. Jim, great
call. Because Orion is rising right now early in the evening, and it looks positively huge on
Exactly. You're so right. And the Big Dipper and all the rest, when they're low, they look enormous.
Right. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thanks, Jim. We appreciate the call. Number to call here is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. And Henry in Cornwall. Henry.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, if you're on speakerphone, I would recommend you go to handset, but we can hear you all right.
I'm on a headset.
Oh, okay.
All right?
Yeah, whatever. Sure. Give it a try.
Okay. I just bought a telescope. I'm retired now. It's something I've always wanted. It's a simple 4-inch Maksutov Cassegrain. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yep, those are good.
And I'm just getting into backyard astronomy, and I've been okay at locating some planets and the Pleiades star cluster, and I'm just wondering, for someone starting off in this part of our planet, what might be some fairly easy-to-find galaxies or nebula or whatever?
Okay. Well, you're going to find with a 4-inch telescope, even though Maxitovs are exquisite, because the aperture is relatively small, galaxies will be disappointing. They're just going to look like blobs. They won't show detail, especially when compared to all the great photographs you've seen. Nothing will show color. And the same with nebula, except for the Orion Nebula, which is out these nights. That'll look nice through that telescope. The best thing through that telescope will be the planets. Saturn will be great this summer. Jupiter will be great throughout the spring. And the moon, my goodness, the moon will be such a knockout. Look for it this month from the 16th to about the 20th of January. Get a clear night. That's when the lighting on the moon will be optimum. And through that telescope that you have, it's just going to just knock your socks off and your neighbors and your friends and everyone else. That would be, people say, oh, the moon, you know, everybody knows about the moon. But wait till you see it through that telescope. It's going to be gorgeous.
Would you? I bought a set of filters too. You use an orange filter?
I don't. No. I don't really think it adds very much. I mean, you might find it helps a little bit with Jupiter, and certainly Mars later this year might show up some details a little bit, but it's very subtle.
Okay. All right. Great. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Henry. I'd like to see the Pleiades through a good telescope.
Pleiades take up so much of the sky, Ray, that they're best through binoculars.
Yeah, and I've done that.
Telescopes zoom in too much, and then you lose the star cluster nature of them. You got to have the whole cluster in the field of view and some surrounding blank dark space so that it looks like a cluster. And the magnification, you can't go above about 20, 25, 30 power. Otherwise, you lose the sense of it being a cluster. And most telescopes, the lowest power is more than that. So it's actually better in either a wide field telescope, extreme low magnification, or good binoculars.
All right. Over to Alex in Hadley, Mass. Alex, you're on.
Hi. Yeah, thanks. So, Bob, I have to say that your explanation of the apparent size of the moon was nothing less than awesome.
Oh, great. Thank you.
I've never heard it put quite so well, especially the interesting part about the actual distance from the observer to the moon.
Yeah, never heard that either.
At different times. Yeah, that is very cool. However, I have a different question. I'm interested in why it is that sunrise and sunset times are different from north to south. And my example is that my immediate family lives in Annapolis, Maryland. I live up here in Western Mass. And right now, sunrise is 5 minutes earlier here, but down there, we're seeing the sun before they do. But then down there in the evening, the sun sets a half an hour later.
Yes.
So sunset here is a half, and yet, you know, that's a half an hour, and a degree is what, I'm thinking about the time zones.
Yes.
Half an hour is half a time zone.
Yes. Well, there you've got two factors going on at once. First, you not only have the north-south factor. Now in winter, of course, as you get further and further north, the nights are longer, the days are shorter, and so, of course, you're going to have a big difference in sunrise and sunset times. Whereas at the equator, do you know that the time of sunset and sunrise, it never varies by a second during the year? It's always 12 hours of day and 12 hours of night. At the poles, it's the other extreme. So when you move even from here to Annapolis, you're going to have a very big difference. But in this case, there's a second factor. We are east of Annapolis, Maryland. They're further west than us. So as
a little bit.
Yes. So as Earth is turning, we're going to hit that line first. We're going to hit the sunrise line and meet the sunset line before people in Annapolis are. And that's going to affect the time of sunset and sunrise, too. So you got both of those.
Right. I get that. But,
you got both of those
factored. Why is there a 5-minute difference in the morning and a half hour difference in the evening?
In between sunrise and sunset?
No. Yeah.
No, there's a 5-minute difference in sunrise in the morning, and there's a half an hour difference in the sunset. in the evening.
Okay, remember that sunrise and sunset times are always averages depending upon where you are in your time zone. Every time zone is 15 degrees on Earth, and okay. So your distance from your time zone determines those things. And so your clock, whether it's sunrise or sunset, is only taking an average time, and there's no official midpoint of it. So where they're located and where their sunrise and sunset is by no means has to be symmetrical around yours.
Okay, that does make sense.
Okay.
Well, thanks,
yeah,
Alex.
I take these things too personally.
Okay.
Well, I think we could probably do a whole show on this, and thank you for the call. Let's go to Linda in Warwick. Linda.
Hello?
Hello.
Oh, hi. You were talking about gravity and motion before, and I was wondering if I know this sounds completely crazy, but I was wondering if you could say that everything is moving in every direction at the same time. Is that something that anybody could actually think about?
No. Things aren't moving in the same in every direction at the same time. No, I don't even know what sense that would make, actually.
Well, it wouldn't make sense to me, but I mean, I was just thinking about it in terms of that, you know, if you have things like all these things like entanglement and things being in the same place at the same time and things moving left-handed or right-handed, is there a specific time in which something that's left-handed could also move right in a right-handed way? You know what I mean? If time and movement are related such that the time sort of makes the motion happen only one direction when it actually has the possibility to happen at another direction, too.
I'm not 100% sure I understand your question, but if we're talking just astronomy here, which is what we're doing, it's true that there's a lot of motions going on at once. For example, in our spinning Earth, we're all heading toward the east as our planet rotates.
Right.
Our planet's going around the sun at these days about 67,000 miles an hour. The sun is going around the center of the galaxy at 144 miles a second. Our galaxy's heading toward Andromeda at 70 miles per second. And all these motions are happening at once in various directions. So if that's what you mean, that on different scales, there's different motions in different directions happening simultaneously, then yes. But is it every direction? And then you'd have to say relative to what?
Yeah. Well, I guess that is my question, relative to. if it's relative to what, and if it only happens, if we can only see, if it's happening on different scales, then isn't it possible, I mean, depending on where you're looking at it from, isn't it possible that the scales could be equalized and then they'd all be happening at once, at the same time?
In the same speed, in the same time? No, I think that would be an oversimplification.
Oh. Linda, congratulations. You have expertly personified the confusion that goes through my head during every appearance Bob Berman is on the show.
Thank you very much.
Good job, Linda. And quickly over to James in Highland. James.
Hey, good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, if you're traveling at the speed of light and you turn your headlights on, does anything happen?
No. That was the amazing thing about light, that it's independent. Light speed is independent of your motion. And that's why if a car is coming toward you on the road, let's do this. You can measure the speed of light in a lab. I've done it. If I can do it, anyone can
do it.
Okay,
fair enough.
So let's say you're measuring the lights from a parked car hitting you, and you're measuring the speed. Now the car starts up, and it's heading toward you as fast as it can go. It's a race car. Let's say it's going 200 miles an hour.
Fair enough.
Do you measure each photon then at the speed of light, 186,282.4 miles per second, plus another 200 miles an hour? No. Regardless of its motion toward you, or maybe your motion toward it, each light photon still has the same speed as before, so that the object that's having the light has no relevance to it. That's one of the shocks and the amazing things that came from Einstein, actually before him, from a few people before him, like Hedrick Lorentz and Fitzgerald and a few others.
All right, James, thanks a lot. I guess we'll have to stop it with the calls for now. Quick email in only about 15 seconds here. Early in the show, I think I heard you talking about whole galaxies going faster than the speed of light. I was taught that matter would disintegrate if it got too close to the speed of light. First, I don't remember why that would happen, so would appreciate a reminder in 12 seconds, Bob. Second, how is that things can pass the speed of light? And if they did, Why can't we recreate that, such as with a spaceship? That's from Paulette. You have 4 seconds. Go.
Simply that, no, nothing that weighs anything can ever be accelerated to the speed of light. And it's not that it would disintegrate. It's that it would, its mass would then be greater than the whole universe, which is impossible. And the amount of energy that you'd need to move at that speed or any faster would be infinite energy. So nothing can accelerate to the universe to the speed of light. We get around this with the universe's expansion, is that nothing is being accelerated. Rather, the space between objects is expanding. And so the objects aren't moving themselves. It's the space between them that's inflating.
Well, we're done. Our superposition says we're done at the end of the show here. Support comes from Waterwheel Village, Galway, New York, specializing in extra-sharp New York cheddar since 1923, offering imported cheddars, specialty cheeses, nostalgic candies, local-based goods, honey, and maple products in every corner of their store. Waterwheelvillage.com. The Hyde Collection and Art Museum at Historic House in Glens Falls, New York, open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 5, Sunday, 12 to 5, HydeCollection.org. Viva Fresh Pasta, 30 years and 30 wines by the glass, European cuisine infused with flavors of the world, Northampton, Massachusetts. Grab life by the knife and fork. VivaFreshPasta.com. And Interim Healthcare, providing companions, aides, and nurses in the home 2 to 24 hours a day so you or a loved one can stay in your home. Supporting the Mohawk Hudson Land Conservancy, InterimHealthcare.com. Well, that's the program. Thanks to Bob Berman. Thanks to Zach Malloy. Thanks to Deb Malik. Thanks to Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, Food Friday.